Okay, welcome back to the Investigative Journal on this October 23rd, 2014 day on our calendar. I'm your host, Greg Anthony, and you're listening again to the Investigative Journal on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. And again, you can get my show every day, Monday through Friday, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., and that's on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Now, I don't think anybody would argue with the statement that every man deserves a fair trial, no matter how small or large the charges are brought against him by the state. The question becomes, how many people don't get that fair trial? And the question also becomes, how many people are really convicted? When you're charged with a more serious crime, it usually gets spread out all over the newspapers, at least if you're not a Catholic priest or the Vatican emissaries that work for them, who do these dastardly deeds that never seem to get reported. Oh, you might get an article on page 27 or 28 or the back pages. But sometimes when a person is charged with a crime, it's splattered all over the newspaper. And how many of us convict that person even before he's had a fair trial? And the reason I say that is because when I went to law school, one of the things that I learned was that the legal system can be manipulated by fast-talking, money-grubbing lawyers and can be manipulated by judges who sit on the bench. Now, we all look at them as these men with these black robes on, and they demand this respect. But you know something? They're nothing but a human being just like you and me, and they only deserve the respect that their job merits. And what I mean by that is if you start looking at all the corrupt judges in our system and all these cases that turn on such flimsy evidence, and when they want to convict somebody, boy, they can do it. And I've seen it over and over again, especially with people who criticize the powers that be, and they get close to their pocketbook or close to the truth. Boy, do they come down on them. And I wonder sometimes how many people have really been convicted even before they step into the courtroom. Now, I'm convinced that the reason I'm doing this Tony Alamo story is because of that reason. I am convinced he was not only convicted in the court of public opinion, but had little chance. When you see this, his motion for a new trial right now, when you see this, you can see how he really had no chance right from the beginning, because the attorney representation in the beginning of his case was horrendous. And that's what I want to talk about today. Now, we all, if you've been following my show, realize that Tony Alamo had criticized the Vatican and the Jesuit order and the powers that be in our country for working together, for the destruction of any kind of Protestant or Bible-believing ministries who talk against the Vatican like they used to back in the time of the Reformation and even at the time of the beginning of this country. And also the secular mishandling of our foreign and domestic policy geared on creating a one-world government, a one-world order, so to speak, one world religion. And he'd been doing it for 40 years. And when you start looking at the insiders who tell me a lot about this case, I start looking at it from a point of view of, boy, you know, if he's not going to get a fair trial in the court of public opinion, if he's not going to get a fair trial in the federal district court in Arkansas, who, by the way, is probably one of the most corrupt in this country, then at least he deserves some fledgling law student like myself to try and at least show you what happened so you can make up your mind. And perhaps I can't undo what has been done in him sitting in jail since 2008, but I can show you how I believe he wouldn't be there if it wasn't for a concerted effort to frame him in the beginning by the government, and secondly, an inadequate trial preparation by his attorneys in the beginning. And I don't know why, but I'm telling you something. There had to be some kind of complicity between the prosecution and the defense in this case. And I will get into that. And if those attorneys want to sue me for libel, go right ahead. Because, you know, you ought to be disbarred for what I see in this case. And to say you're a defense attorney is ridiculous. I mean, I could have picked a law student in first year and done a better job than this. And in fact, I think there was something going on behind the scenes. Now, I've talked to insiders on this case who give me some information regarding what went on in the beginning, what's going on now. And I'm going to refer later in this show or tomorrow to the court documents as far as the inadequate preparation of trial. Because I've already went over some of the flimsy evidence in his document, which is a 49-page motion for retrial and overturn the conviction. It's been sitting on the judge's desk for a couple of years, and that's ridiculous in itself. However, I might add, even though the attorney right now is doing an adequate job, it's hard to undo what's already been put in the record. And you'll find in this case that on the prosecution side, the judge had allowed so much evidence that wasn't related specifically to the charges. Evidence about his conviction for IRS violations, evidence about perhaps mishandling money, all these things that were brought up which have nothing to do with the charges at hand, but I believe were brought in and allowed by the judge to taint the jury and convict him not for the evidence presented, but for external evidence that maybe should have never, probably should have never got in. At least, at the minimum, his attorneys in the beginning should have objected strenuously and did it with a idea that they understood the law. But when you see all the things that the few simple objections that were made, my goodness, you could have been at a moot court. Third year law student, when you do it as a law student, you present kind of a mock trial. And I've seen my fellow students do a better job of objecting than these guys. And a man's life was on the line. And whether you agree with him or not, I think you have to agree with me that every person, no matter what, deserves a fair trial. But my question lingers, how many of us really believe that goes on? And how many of us really convict people just by what they read in the newspapers or see on CNN? So, another thing, this case should have never been brought in Arkansas. There was no person around that wasn't tainted already about this ministry for wrong. I mean, it's incredible. I made a lot of phone. I had somebody working for me at the time, and we were covering this story from afar, and we called a number of businesses just out of the blue in Fauk, Arkansas, where this trial took place, you know, in that area where it took place, and we asked, what do you think of the Tony Alamo ministry? And you should have heard, not one. They felt it was a cult. They felt, we don't know what's going on there. When? You could just walk in there. It was an open door situation. But they had already been tainted by what they had read in the newspapers, by what they'd been told. You know, it's a small little town. And, by the way, there was a lawsuit of, well, the ministry used to put up things on windshields, you know, newsletters. And by God, they're better than those pizza newsletters that they allow to do. But, you know, the Fauk, Arkansas city, I guess, and one of those little, I think it's that city, put up an ordinance. They couldn't do that, and that was overturned when the ministry filed a lawsuit and said that was a violation of their First Amendment rights. But they're doing everything possible to taint people. And so this case should have never been brought there, and it was. And how are you going to get a fair jury? I mean, you're not. So let's go back and look at what a couple insiders told me about this case, about the preparation for trial. And then let's look after that at some of the legal motions made regarding this adequate preparation. Some of the witnesses, many of the witnesses that were on Tony's behalf that were never, ever even questioned by the defense attorneys. But on the other hand, there was so much extraneous evidence brought in unrelated to the charges against him that it seemed to me a lot, you know, if you look at that scale of justice, It was lopsided in this case. But right now, the attorney that's doing this is doing an adequate job, but he can't undo the record due to some of these horrible negligence of the original trial attorneys, with almost no preparation, according to insiders that knew the case and were trying to help Tony, and no investigation into the complaining witnesses. Not only did they not investigate the complaining witnesses and the government's irregularity in taking them and sequestering them in some kind of organization where they prodded them, promised them things to get this kind of testimony, and they found four or five girls that did. Now, normal preparation for his trial was not done by the original attorney hired as soon as he was Tony was arrested, and he did little on the case. And finally, that people close to the attorney got so worried, they hired a second attorney from Beverly Hills, California, who did even less than the first one. Then we hired a third attorney, they said, from Houston, Texas, for the sole purpose of trying to get Tony out of jail until the trial, which he failed to accomplish. Getting extremely close to trial with absolutely no preparation done at this time, going through three attorneys, according to insiders, and always paying out of pocket. Paying. They'd paid over, I think the original retainer was $350,000. Davis asked for a three-month trial extension, and this is that, one of the Beverly Hills attorneys asked for a three-month trial extension and got 2 months, but was such an incompetent lawyer, according to insiders, that Tony fired him. The other guy fired too when he came on, so they were left with this local attorney, okay, named from Texarkana. Oh boy, I'm sure that guy didn't know the prosecution well, did he? It was a disaster, according to people close to this case. They never spoke to the witnesses or possible witnesses that should have been used. And I'm going to go refer to the legal document and show you what they did after this. They did not investigate into the complaining witnesses. Almost no cross-examination took place. Oh, my. The judge was constantly cutting the defense off and letting the lying witnesses, according to insiders who were at the trial supporting Tony, ramble on and on. And one person put it to me, it was a kangaroo court, was putting it mildly. I'd always say, as a law student, and I purely look at this from a legal point of view, folks, and by God, there should be somebody that does this. And it's so sad that it has to be done so late and on a show like this. But I just wonder how many other people have gotten screwed. I can't even imagine throughout the years with a supposed legal system that's the best in the world. We have the best PR program in almost everything. I was talking about that this morning. Oh, we can tell the whole world we're the best country in the world. We have the best legal system in the world. We know how to do that. We hire a few people from Hollywood, and guess what? We've got the greatest ad campaign going. But, and people all over the world think it's the greatest country in the world until they live here. Then they might change their mind. But, okay, so according to close insiders to this case, it was a kangaroo court. The head special FBI agent, Randall Harris, in this case, sat at the prosecutor's table and coached the main witness on the stand with head shaking no when that answer was yes. That she and she spoke, according to insiders who were trying to get this stuff, told to the defense just didn't listen, or maybe they didn't want to listen. Randall Harris, this guy, Harris easily over 80, was saying that she'd speak to Harris easily over 80 times before the trial. This one witness was pampered by the FBI and given a phone that they kept in constant contact with her on. They gave her presents on her birthday, Valentine's Day, etc. The FBI agent even offered to adopt her. Her mother could tell you what a horrible liar her daughter was. Yes, But did her mother ever get on the stand? I think she had to take the fifth, thinking she was going to lose her children, other children. I don't know. There was so many irregularities. And somebody wrote to me on this and said, you know, I could write all day about this stuff, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I know you only have an hour show, but you can thank you for doing this, they say. Please, no one else is. And the attorneys refused to subpoena John Peeler to testify when he knew how the government had a vendetta against Tony. And I get into that. It's even in the record in the trial. And we've had John Peeler on this show telling us what they've done for 40 years. And did the jury ever get a chance to hear this? No. And they were going to keep, vendetta. And they were going to, and Peeler would testify, they were going to keep trying until they got him in jail. And even foretold that they'd try to claim child porn, as they did, and never even checked computers when they went in there. And there wasn't any to begin with. But they said as Tony was in jail in the beginning, he was really close to dying and lost over 70 pounds before trial and almost had kidney failure and no Medicaid, no great medical attention for a long time. And he could not make them do anything. They didn't even communicate with him, the trial attorneys. The only one that came to see him was the one investigator we hired, but it just wasn't enough. And that's coming from an insider from the Alamo Ministries trying to help him at the time. Now, he was held pre-trial from October 2008 to February 2010 in Bowie County Correctional Center, a makeshift private jail only a few yards from the main commercial train convergence in Texarkana. So trains wailed right next to you, next to him all day and night. It's a long cinder block building with leaking roofs. In 2009, it was extremely cold winter, and he went through it in the horrible circumstances. You know, this reminds me of the gulag up in, Siberia, for Christ. I called everyone. They were calling everybody at the ministry when he had to live in below freezing cell. I mean, he's an older guy. Well, they want to kill him before trial, so they don't have to even go through the kangaroo court. The jail even lied to his friends, saying they had heat when they didn't. The guy in the cell next to him insisted there was ice in the toilets. That's how bad it was there. He rarely got out of the cell at all, excuse me, and possibly for an hour every few days. But usually it was too cold to go out anyway. Food was bad and edible sometimes. Water from the sink undrinkable. Several times Tony knew he got wrong medicine because after taking it, remember, he was almost blind and he couldn't even see what they were giving him. He felt paralyzed or extremely sick. Some of his friends said they really it was just incredible, they said. And what they really were trying to say is these conditions were abominable, and his trial was even worse. When you file a 220, it's called a 2255 motion. That's the motion, and he filed a 2255 amended petition. It has no time constraint, so the magistrate judge can sit on it forever, I guess, if he wants. And he has been doing that so far. Now, let me see where we sit as far as time here. Oh, we got about 5 minutes, so I'm going to get into something real quick. So basically, after all is said and done, before we get into all the witnesses that were not called, and to show you how this was basically, how can you get a defense if you don't have a defense? If your attorney just sits there and doesn't cross-examine, if your attorney doesn't even investigate the complaining witnesses or get to the bottom of what they're saying. And in this case, a lot of the testimony that was put in this trial was extraneous evidence that had nothing to do with the Mann Act, which he was charged with intending to take minors with the help of others for sexual purposes across state lines. Now, there were 5 young women that were labeled as victims in the 2008 case by the government. Now, there are always lots of people every day living in this church, in this ministry. And every one of these five had permission from their parents to live at either the school or the mission and kept in close contact with them after they moved there. Parents visited whenever they wanted. They weren't kept out. In fact, I learned from the people there and a number of people that should have been called to testify that they could have gone back home to their parents anytime they wanted. I'm not going to read their names. And they did go back to their parents at various times and only to return and continue living at the ministry. Some of these had problems at home and preferred that. Now, all of these five, it's interesting, left between 2003 and 2006. And there was not one complaint. They didn't go to the FBI and complain. They didn't do anything. Then all at once, when the ministry started getting calls that the FBI was scouring the U.S. for anyone who would testify against Tony. They hounded many people who told us they were, you know, told the ministry that they refused offers of money. So the FBI is offering money to these people to come and talk. How many people tell the truth when there's a lot of money on the table? Think about that. And is that proper procedure of the FBI? Now, was any of this ever brought up in trial? No. Don't you think if I was a defense attorney, if I even was a law student investigator working with the defense, I would say we should interview these people that were hounded and get them on the stand and show what the FBI was really doing. Not to mention John Peeler, the FBI undercover agent who was assigned to bring Tony down and frame him. Now, they called their homes. Now, do you remember, let's just bring this up, you know, as an analogy here. What about the Kobe Bryant rape case? Remember that? Here's this rich basketball player, Kobe Bryant, you know, intelligent guy, $40 million a year. All of a sudden, he's in Michigan getting his knee worked on, and a girl goes to the, accuses him of rape. He's charged with rape. And I'm telling you, he was basically acquitted, or the charges were dropped. But the point I'm trying to make is, people do lie. Now, why would she lie? Well, maybe she's thinking of a civil case afterwards, and Kobe had a lot of money. Now, he had a fairly decent defense, and he could afford it, and he had attorneys, and he had people behind him, and he had a good reputation. He'd never been in this situation before. But in Alamo's case, he had no one behind him, and he had a government out to get him. On charges that were a lot flimsier than the charges brought against Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant was... And eventually the charges were either, I can't remember, dropped or he was acquitted. I think they were dropped even before trial. And he went on with his basketball career. And I'm going to get back to the Alamo case in a minute because we're running out of time. But I brought that up just to show you that people will lie when they see money on the table. And guess what happened in the Alamo case? There was a civil case afterwards and the award was $532 million. Largest in Arkansas history, and guess who's going to get a piece of that pie? So, let's think about it, folks. There's a lot of factors here that add up to what these people say. It was a kangaroo court and a frame job from the beginning, and all I want to do is bring the evidence out so we can figure this out. I'll be back in 3 minutes on the Investigative Journal.
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net. Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. That's crosstheborder.org.
I know you all want answers, and believe me, so do I, and I'll do my best to get them.
Despite Nicolas Cage's promise to do his best to get Left Behind Rapture answers for us, don't hold your breath. Not everyone believes Left Behind is true prophecy. Some may even regard as conspiratorial the mainstream re-release of the Left Behind movie with actor Nicolas Cage portraying the main character as an attempt to further reinforce in the minds of all this perception of false prophecy in order to condition the masses for the play about to begin. If you want true Bible prophecy answers, get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. The author exposes the Latin rapture origin, the seven-year tribulation deception, true Bible revelation of Daniel's 70 weeks, the abomination of desolation, the restrainer, America in the revelation, the image of the beast, and the mark of the beast, and the truth about God's chosen people, and so much more about Bible prophecy. This book will shatter the left-behind paradigm of future events. Get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. Visit crosstheborder.org, C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org, to get your print, EPUB, or PDF version of the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. That's crosstheborder.org.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen. There's a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and to our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Investigative Journal, and why don't we just get right back to it? I'm looking at all this information that had been given to me by some insiders, people trying to tell me what was going on. I remember at that ministry, and how none of this stuff was ever brought up for Tony's defense, and. Like I said, every man deserves a defense, and how can you not get convicted if you don't have one? And basically, he didn't have one when you look at this case. Now, we're talking a lot of the stuff I'm getting, the information. I remember calling that ministry back then and talking to a number of people, and I said, hey, what? Tell me, you know, are these charges true? Have you seen anything, any glimpses that this guy... Tony was a sexual predator on children? He said, no, I've known him for 40 years, and I talked to numerous people. And they live in tight quarters there. Everybody knows everybody. And I'm sure that if there was something going on, someone over the years would have went to the FBI prior to them having to search out everybody and coerce people to testify. With the olive branch of money hanging out there. Now, I've learned that they hounded many people And many of these people refused offers of money to come into the FBI and talk. They called their homes at work day and night. And I know of one family who actually went into hiding to get away from the constant harassment because they would not agree to go along with what the FBI was promising. Now, all these people should have been allowed to testify, right? They weren't. They weren't even investigated by the defense. Now, again, these girls were around lots of people every day, I learned. The girls that they finally, these five girls that they finally are labeled as victims, they are their teachers, the adults who lived there, their parents, and anyone who came over, which was a lot of people every day at that ministry. And the office was like Grand Central Station there, according to a number of people, very busy with people coming and going day and night. And there were no complaints other than squabbles with friends. Of course, you never, you know, we're always going to have these. Certainly, there wasn't any mention that I found out, or the people that I talked to, or people that wrote me, of any discontent towards Tony. As a matter of fact, each of these were at various times for being, the five victims, various times were being very disruptive or causing problems in school or with others. Or in one case, one of the victims lying and was actually told to leave and move to another location. Each one of the victims asked to return. And they, in times, directly wrote to Tony and told him they were sorry for the trouble they had caused and could they please come back. Many of these handwritten letters are still in the possession of the ministry, but they were never presented in trial. You know, handwriting was never verified. I mean, you can authenticate it simply by bringing that document in and having that witness cross-examined and say, do you recall this letter? You know, authenticate the letters. That wasn't done. Why did they, you know, and I asked the question, why did these people finally, after being hounded by the FBI and brought in, why'd they do all this if they were victims? Why did they ask to come back? And why weren't these letters ever authenticated at trial? Now, one of the girls came from a large family. And all the kids were pretty good kids, I learned. But this one was kind of a troublemaker, so to speak. Labeled by many people there as a habitual liar, schemer. And her mother finally gave up and just could not handle it. The mother asked if she could stay at school and stay with the mission and with her mother's sister, her aunt, who this victim loved, supposedly. It seemed to really help get her straightened out a little bit, I learned from people, to a degree. And her mother frequently visited and went home often on weekends or school vacations. And she also lived for almost a half a year with her mother before she returned back to the school in Mission. But according to people there, she continued to lie and connive, and it really never stopped. I also found out the cross-examination on this victim was nil, next to none. Her mother and father knew how easily used by the FBI she was. She was sent to a place in Wellspring called Wellsprings in Albany, Ohio, for a two-week intensive counseling period with the FBI. Now, is this normal? A lot of people do, you know. She loved the constant attention, according to those around her. And they were giving her that. I was told she was made to feel like she was the center of their world and that she ate it up when they gave her balloons and gifts on Valentine's Day. And they gave her presents, according to people, all the way up until trial. Now, did you hear any of this in the trial? No. Now, they also found out, now, where's the investigator? Where's the money being used by these defense attorneys? I mean, $350,000, you should be able to hire, they could have hired me. But I might have found out some things the judge over there in this corrupt court didn't want to hear. Now, government paid for phone calls upon which they kept tight tabs on her and kept her under their control, according to those that investigated this. We're trying to get this stuff to the defense attorneys, but never got there. They acted like they were so concerned, according to these people, for her and helped her move, get a job. And she admitted she was paid for. When she admitted on the stand, she never even spent one day on the job. But she got paid, and so much more. She admitted the special FBI agent called her at least 80 times before the trial. All the while, he was sitting at the head of the prosecution table, according to witnesses at the trial, coaching her by shaking his head no. Several people watched this from the gallery, although in the end he denied it, of course. He had a twitch in his neck. Yeah, okay. Now, also I learned when her mother tried to get on the witness stand for Tony against her, and to testify against her daughter, the prosecutor, knowing how to shut her up, asked her where she lived and where her other children were. She knew Child Protective Services would take them instantly, as there was still a standing pickup order that she was promptly served as she arrived at the court to testify. So she's given this pickup order to get her other children, and guess what? She had no choice, folks, to plead the fifth. That shut her down. The judge told her to step down. He didn't ask, hey, prosecutor, come over here, and defense attorney, did you give him a pickup order that you're going to pick up her children, her other children, before she testified? That alone is coercion. That alone shows you they shut this woman down. They didn't want to hear anything that might contradict this flimsy evidence they were presenting. And so, to save her other children, she just pled the fifth. The judge told her to step down. He told the jury to strike anything they heard her say. He repeated it again in the next morning. They didn't want to hear anything that might help this guy. Now, another one was let's see what kind of time we got here. I always try to, I get carried away sometimes and I forget we're on a time schedule. Oh, we're only 9 minutes into the show here, so we got some time. Amy, I'm not going to get into their names. We can just call them these. I use an A name. She and her mother and her siblings moved into the ministry, I learned, in Fort Smith around 1996. And they had left their dad when he was found to be cheating on his wife. Now, when you get people in this ministry, you're going to get people with problems. I remember when this ministry started, they used to work on Hollywood Boulevard, picking up drug addicts and taking them in and trying to help them out. So can you imagine what could have went? I mean, I'm telling you something. Tony wasn't dealing with the rich and famous here, like he did when he was a movie or a record producer. He was dealing with people with serious problems, whether it be family problems or whether it be drug problems, alcohol problems, and trying, in a sense, to help them out. So they had left their dad. He was cheating on his wife. And this one victim didn't get along with her mother, according to people I talked to, and asked to move to the Falk School and Mission before Tony got out of prison in 1998. And that's when he got framed for those IRS charges, just like Tupper Saucy did, for speaking out against the Vatican. Now, at the time I found out, in 2003, she was causing a lot of trouble at the church. She had an out-of-control temper, and she was very angry at another person who lived there as well, another girl who lived there as well. In fact, people there in charge told her to move back with her mother. They couldn't handle it anymore. But she didn't get along with her and didn't want that. She was given an alternative, I found out, of moving to another house nearby with other people, but she didn't want to do that either. Instead, she chose to move to Oklahoma and live with her father. And at the time of the raid and Tony's arrest, her dad sent emails of support to Tony. She sent an email sending regards to all after leaving. No hostility. Eventually, she was contacted, though, by these FBI. You know, they're scouring the country, and I know this for a fact. And even the judge, after he was arrested, they picked up about 7 or 8 children at the Falk, Arkansas ministry. But the next day, the judge put out an order to arrest anybody at any of the ministries. Go look for all of these kids and get them into custody. They're all in danger. Danger of what? So back to this other victim. After he was arrested, her dad had sent emails of support. And in fact, I learned from people there that she sent an email sending regards to all after leaving. No hostility eventually. Now, eventually then, she was contacted by the FBI and sent to Wellspring. Again, she was sent there with her child for 2 weeks. Now she's in the FBI custody up there in Wellspring for 2 weeks. And I learned that the same thing happened with the other victim, happened to this victim's mother. They questioned her on her children's, other children's whereabouts, where she was forced to plead the fifth again. Nothing. And in fact, her testimony was incomplete and completely stricken from the record. Now, another one, a victim, lived in New Jersey with her family till her mother and her dad and her sister drove off one day in 2001. They moved to Texarkana. Later, they both lived, I learned, in the house next to the school in Mission there. Eventually, one of the sisters went to live with her mother and another one came back to live with the ministry in 2003. The ministry told me they were, this all should have been allowed, you know, investigated, that this victim and her mother were being harassed by the FBI and kept trying to hold them off, but finally they agreed to meet with them. The FBI offered to send this victim to an art college, they were told, and she agreed to be a witness as well as her mother did. Now, you know, none of this stuff investigated properly. How can the guy get a fair trial? I mean, whether you agree with his spirituality and his Bible believing ways, or whether you don't, you can't dismiss the fact that you live in America and supposedly we're to get fair trials, all of us. Just like Kobe Bryant, no different. Now, another victim lived next to the door to the school in Mission and came over every day with her sister, according to things I found out. And it was fine with their parents. Her mother stopped in often and visited with her outside while they played after school. The sisters both moved back home after a while. Then in 2003, this one victim moved back to the school in Mission. And after 2 or 3 years, she went back to live with her parents then. Then they were told by people, I learned in the ministry, and then I learned from this, that they were told the FBI was contacting family members, and this victim's grandfather was really trying to get this victim to be a witness. And she eventually went to live with him, and she too became a hostile witness. Again, not investigated, and here we go. We have another one, another victim. In 1993, her parents moved into the house in Fort Smith just a few months before they left for Memphis for Tony's RLS trial to begin in 93. They moved to Memphis with them. Her parents and her family moved there as well on Tony's ticket. Then they moved to Colorado when Tony was assigned to a prison in Florence, Colorado. Her family moved there also, so she was always around her family. Now, I learned that in 2000, she actually accused her own father of having sexual relations with her. Due to this, her family moved away from the ministry. Years later, she admitted if she really was not true, it wasn't true, but the damage had been done to her entire family. So she lied about that. This was never brought up in trial, I don't believe. And in 2005, she decided to go back and live with them. Well, within a few months, she called and spoke to a friend at the church, I heard, crying and very depressed and wanted to come there. And when she was told she could come back, she immediately did. But in 2006, due to her terrible lying, I heard from the people there, from the past, in her very bad attitude and more, she was asked to leave. She didn't want to go, but couldn't stay any longer. I found out that the FBI started trying to get her. According to people I talked to, she insisted she wanted nothing to do with them in the beginning, but then for some reason she started to cooperate. Could it be promises for money? Who knows? Some people believe that she was threatened with her parents being prosecuted if she didn't comply. So maybe to protect them, she had to turn on Tony. She too went to Wellspring for 2 weeks and was paid for going. So we have a lot of things here that, to me, show that a lot of this stuff should have been brought up in trial, and perhaps if it was, even a tainted jury would have a bad conscience about convicting this man when they hear a real defense of what was really going on. But when this stuff is never heard, what do you think is going to happen? Just what one person told me, worse than a kangaroo court, and Tony sits in jail to this day, charged with 175 years, convicted of that. While this petition, now I got about 6 minutes, and I'm going to start getting into it today, and then I'll finish it up tomorrow. And we're going to look, it's like I said in the beginning, at some of the, first of all, I got into a lot of the inadequate defense, and it's listed all into this document. But basically, it states that the attorney writing this said that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, and the attorneys were ineffective among many other ways in the following regard. And we'll start right here. Counsel failed to conduct adequate, and this is in his 2255 motion for new trial, based on the fact he didn't get a fair trial. Let's just put it in layman's terms. Counsel failed to conduct adequate investigation and interview and or utilize witnesses that the defendant had identified as having information useful to his defense. And there's an exhibit that I read to you earlier in the trial record by Sharon Alamo that lists of numerous witnesses that never were contacted or even got on to Tony's defense, got to talk about Tony's defense. Now, in this document, in the 2255 motion here, the counsel says that the attorney writing this, who's having, you know, to deal with the record that he was given, and I'm telling you, he has a tough job ahead of him. But he says, on the record, Marianne Barnett, an eyewitness who was on the trip from Falk to Nashville in February 1999, count six of the indictment, Barnett witnessed firsthand that the victim was sent back to Arkansas from Nashville early. While defendant remained in Nashville, Barnett's testimony that defendant sent this victim away from Nashville while he remained supports the conclusion that he did not transport her from Nashville for sexual purposes. And it says, see Exhibit 4, the affidavit of Marianne Barnett. Then he states in B, the second witness, one another witness, John Peeler, had information, this is the FBI informant, regarding long-standing efforts by the federal government to attempt to prosecute the defendant, Tony Alamo. Peeler worked unofficially as an undercover agent for the FBI, was sent to investigate him in the 1980s, and knew there was a standing effort to build a case of some kind against him. See Exhibit 5, and we'll get to John Peeler's affidavit in future shows, although we've interviewed him on this show many times. Then we look at Deborah Andrasek, among other knowledge, had personal knowledge of the circumstances of the California trip of another victim charged as one of the accounts in the indictment. Mrs. Andrasek was personally aware of the victim and her daughter had packed their bags in hopes of going on this bus trip for the state. That defendant did not want to take them, and that both of the victim requested permission to go on the trip. Was about to walk on right before they took off on the bus. The evidence belies the conclusion that the defendant had any motive to bring the victim on a trip charged in the indictment. Now, the point I'm trying to make is this stuff needs to be. Look, you got to have this. I mean, this is stuff that's relevant to the charges, so relevant that if you don't put this in the trial, how can you say this guy got a fair trial? And that's all I'm saying here. My goodness. You know, let's not convict this man based on a kangaroo court, which seems to be the case. And when you look at all this evidence that was not even investigated upon or brought him, you know, this stuff the jury needs to hear. But if they don't hear it, how can they do otherwise? Now, they go on. There's, let me see how much time I got here. I only got about a minute and a half, so I'm going to stop right there. And I got about a lot more witnesses to talk about, showing that the defense was non-existent. And in that case, you know, I don't know how a judge can sit and, you know, I guess what he does is he just, you know, listens to this and then just kind of like turns a blind eye. But I mean, there's a question. You know, a judge has the right to listen and say, listen, you know, if I heard about this stuff going on, and you know, you could actually talk to these attorneys and say, are you, you know, my friend here, you know, every person deserves a fair trial. Now, if you're not giving this guy a fair trial, I can dismiss you and get, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, but he probably just sat there and said, oh, this is all we got. So let's get this on. And in 10 days, with all this stuff, in 10 days, they convicted this man. That, I mean, I've seen petty theft trials go on longer than that. But anyway, we're all out of time today. Come back tomorrow. We're going to finish up on this story. Thanks for listening, and good night.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a